Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Delighted to welcome this morning a group of students from Monticello High School. Would they stand, please? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. This program invites students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And if they do, they will get briefs of the case they will hear. They may do additional work on that case, and then they come to court, listen to the oral arguments, and meet with a justice after our second case this morning. Our summaries of the case we are about to hear out in the foyer, or the marshal has additional copies. It's a good idea, if you haven't read about the case, that you do so. It will make the oral argument more interesting and intelligible. If anyone would like a summary, just raise your hand and the marshal will give it to you, if you haven't the briefs, etc. We've met you. It's now time for you to meet the court, and I'm going to start on my immediate right with Justice John Wilcox. He is the justice with whom you'll be meeting after lunch today, and everybody is invited to that session. It's not limited to the students. The discussion will be on the procedures in the court, not the substance and substantive issues of the case we're about to hear. Seated next to Justice Wilcox is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's left is Justice David Prosser, and on his left is Justice Lewis Butler. That's the lineup for today. So, we are left. Not immediately. So, our first case is 03-0801, Gerald Grahams et al. Versus Milk Products, Inc. Representing Gerald Grahams is Bryce A. Tundra. Mr. Rogers will introduce Mr. Tundra, who was admitted pro hoc vici in the Court of Appeals, and seek admission here. Counsel.
Good morning. My pleasure to introduce Attorney Bryce Tundra. Attorney Tundra has practiced law since 1967. Presently, he's a member in good standing of the State Bar of Colorado, and he's a co-counsel in this case for the plaintiff's appellants, and he will be giving the oral arguments for our position.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Tundra, you're admitted pro hoc vici for about the next hour, and that's it. Please proceed. You have 25 minutes to make your principal argument. Mr. Henkel will then proceed for 30 minutes, and you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
The issue that brings us before this court this morning is one of law, and I think can simply be defined or classified or put into the pigeonhole of the question of what is the meaning in the realm of product liability law of the term other property. We all have lived with 402A of the Restatement of Torts for quite some years now, and we all know that that section provides that injury to person or other property of a consumer gives rise to strict liability if the product is dangerous. Now, there has been what I believe to be some engrafting or an attempt to engraft on the scope of the meaning of other property a term or a condition that is not well founded in tort policy. Tort policy basically has a dual purpose in our system of jurisprudence. That being, particularly as it relates to product liability law, the policy is to protect the consumer from defective products, and equally important, to encourage the manufacturer to make a safe product.
Mr. Condre, if I might interrupt you, why should our focus be on products liability and tort rather than on the economic loss doctrine and on contract?
Oh, I think the focus, and I didn't mean to say that the focus should not be on economic loss law. I think it should, because the question is, does the economic loss doctrine take this case outside of the restatement? So I didn't mean to say that, but I do think that the central focus of the question is, what is the meaning of other property? Are we to is the court to define it what I characterize as the bright line rule, or is the court to engraft upon it some meaning beyond the bright line rule? I thought.
What's your bright line rule?
I think the best statement of the bright line rule is found in the Dan and Jansen case, which is a 1998 case, and I think it says it pretty succinctly. It says, in short, economic loss is damage to a product itself or monetary loss caused by the defective product, which does not cause personal injury or damage to other property. I have always read that case as meaning that the test is, do you have damage to other property as a result of a defective product? Now, what brings us here is the question of, are we going to engraft upon that simple statement a requirement that the damage to other property be an unanticipated damage? Or are we simply going to live with a rule that says if you have damage to other property, you have the right to recover in court? Now, in pondering this question of whether to follow that rule, I have to hearken back to, I think, Northridge, which is discussed at length in the briefs. And My learned opponent in this case characterizes Northridge as a case which basically espouses or develops a hazardous product exception to the economic loss rule. I don't agree with that characterization of Northridge, and I think Northridge is bottomed on, again, the bright line rule that if you have damage to other property, you have a right to recover in tort. And I find I find comfort for that statement that I just made in the concluding paragraph that this court wrote. It said, we conclude that the plaintiff's allegation that the defendant, that the defendant's asbestos-containing product physically harmed the plaintiff's building is the type of injury which is actionable under claims for relief in strict product liability and negligence.
That was an asbestos case.
Are you saying the milk replacer? The difference between this milk replacer and the ordinary is this was a non-medicated product. This didn't have the medication in it. And what I'm interested in is how this differs or doesn't differ from the other cases that Wisconsin has had, like Wausau Tile, which is sort of a seminal case.
Well, let me address then your question with respect to Wausau Tile, Your Honor. Wausau Tile is different in the sense, as this court expressed, that the plaintiff was differently situated than the plaintiff in Northridge. The court said in this case that the plaintiff, Wausau Tile, did not have standing to bring claims for injury to other property because the injury was to the other property of Wausau Tile's customers. And while I recognize that that in the Wausau Tile case, this language is probably dicta. The court says this case would be more analogous to Northridge procedurally if the plaintiff were a third-party owner of property damaged by the defective pavers or even a pedestrian injured by the pavers. Wausau Tile and the plaintiffs in Northridge simply are not similarly situated. Wausau Tile was a case where Wausau sued the concrete manufacturer. The concrete was the glue, so to speak, that held the aggregates together that made the tile and truly did become an integrated product. I guess I concur with the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers in saying that, in their statement that an argument that feed given to calves is a component part of the calf is an absurdity. I just don't think that we have here a component products case. The Grahams bought calves, which, for the purpose of raising, they bought feed for the purpose of nourishing them. The feed didn't nourish the calves, it killed them.
Counsel, maybe you don't believe this is a component product case, but let me use a different phrase,
okay.
An integrative system. Why isn't this one literally feeding the other? You know, why isn't this an integrated system? A la Wausau Tile.
Why isn't gasoline an integrated system of the internal combustion engine? Why isn't electricity a component part of a computer? I mean, when you have a surge coming from the power company that blows up your computer, is that an integrated system? I haven't found a single case that would treat this as an integrated system. And, you know, I thought it was interesting that In the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers brief, they cited to the Saratoga case out of the United States Supreme Court, which I think is a much further stretch. There, we clearly have a component, and the Supreme Court distinguishes, the U.S. Supreme Court distinguishes there in that the component was added afterwards. And therefore, it is not part of the product damaging itself.
Counselor, you want to get out of the economic loss doctrine and back into regular old product liability law, right? You'd like to step outside the economic loss doctrine and have us conclude that this product should be subject to regular tort law, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And isn't one of the components you'd have to prove then that this feed was unreasonably dangerous, not just that it didn't meet expectations, but you'd have to prove it was unreasonably dangerous, correct?
I think so.
All right. And what can you tell me is in the record to show that this feed is unreasonably dangerous?
I think there's a fact issue in the record that the feed is unreasonably dangerous.
How so?
Well, I think the fact that the feed is below the advertised recommendations.
That's not meeting expectations, though.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, unreasonably dangerous has a definition in Wisconsin. It's not just any time you buy a product that isn't quite as good as you think it ought to have been or doesn't meet representations that were made about the product, like the best ever feed, your calves will grow three times as fast. Those are not the kinds of things that are going to give you an unreasonably dangerous product. I mean, if there were arsenic in the feed, then I would say, hey, if that's the fact you got in your case, you've got the component that you need there. But I keep wondering, what did milk products do wrong if they made the feed according to what Cargill told them and it just didn't meet expectations? And that's what I'm troubled with.
They didn't make the feed according to what Cargill told them. They used least cost ingredients, which didn't comply with or satisfy the formula of Cargill.
But wasn't that the expectation, the idea, just so I understand,
right?
Medicated calf replacer, basically this is a milk replacer we're talking about. Generally, it was all medicated. This didn't have the medication in, and therefore, it was less expensive. And I believe that there was this discussion between the supplier, the salesman, and the Grahams as far as this type of replacer. And that is, so they discussed what they were getting, and just so I understand on the reasonable expectation or the loss of expectation, the calves did not perform as they thought they would. Is that a misstatement? You said that the calves died. I think the calves didn't gain weight. They got sick. And then when they quit using this product and went back to something else, the calves regained their health, as I read the facts. Now, that may be a bit of hyperbole. I don't know, but that's what I read.
Well, I think your question has about three parts. One, there is testimony in the record that removal of the medication had no effect on the health of the calves. That's from Sheila McGurk, the vet school. With respect to what they bargained for, a product that was identical to that they were getting before, except for the medication. They didn't bargain with milk products. They bargained with Cargill,
right?
Cargill went to milk products and said, we want the same product without the medication. Cargill didn't get from milk products the same product without the medication. They got a product with respect to which milk products substituted ingredients, least cost ingredients, which we contend caused the product to be dangerous to the calves. Now, are we gonna split hairs or as to what degree of danger there needs to be? Do we need to?
Let me interrupt you at this point. Sort of, I'd like to follow through with both Justice Wilcox and Justice Rogensack's questions, because I think they were touching on something that was central to the Court of Appeals decision, and that was the idea of disappointed expectations. As you know, there are three cases that come from the Court of Appeals, the most recent being Selzer, of the three prior cases to this case, where the Court of Appeals has held that if you've got disappointed expectations, that you do not have an other property situation. How do you respond to that? You've been talking, and both of the other justices we're talking in terms of disappointed expectations. What's your answer to that argument?
I guess my answer to that argument is more of a question than anything else. How do we ever know? How do we as lawyers and how do the circuit judges who are having to referee our disputes ever know what constitutes unanticipated or damage to other property in an unanticipated manner was the language that I believe was used in this case. But when you go to Seltzer, which is another court of appeals case, the court says, well beyond failure to perform as expected. Are we going to have a trial in every case as to what the expectation of the consumer is? And is this going to be a subjective standard or is it going to be an objective standard? I think that we are moving away from with this engrafting of this definition on other property. I think we're moving away from what public policy throughout the years has dictated with respect to product liability law. The objective of product liability law is to encourage the manufacturer to make a safe product. Here, uniquely in Wisconsin, there must be privity in order to have an action against a remote manufacturer. What is there to encourage a remote manufacturer to make a safe product if that remote manufacturer is exempt from tort law?
It seems to me that what you're doing is moving again away from focus on the economic loss doctrine and telling us about tort law. And obviously the purpose of the economic loss doctrine is to separate tort law from contract law, especially in the commercial setting, as we have in this case. And I'm having trouble with your questions, if you will, and you not really addressing what the Court of Appeals held and what they've held in three prior cases, that if you have disappointed expectations, you can't have an other property exception. That seems to me to be the heart of this case. And I'm wondering what your response is to that.
Well, I look at the Court of Appeals decisions, and what I see is confusion and chaos. I mean, you've got the potato case in Spychella. Okay, the product did not. I'm not even sure I can articulate it, but the product was supposed to prevent the potatoes from rotting. Well, the potatoes didn't rot.
They petrified.
But they petrified. Well, in the Graham's case, the milk replacer was supposed to nourish the cows. It didn't nourish the cows. It killed them. Now, does that mean the Graham's case fits within Spychella? Then you go to the Harbiter. And the Harbiter, I think, again, is more like perhaps Wes Otal, but not really like Wes Otal. In the Harbiter, the silo was supposed to enrich the grain. It didn't enrich the grain, so the cows got sick. Well, the dangerous product is the silo that affected the corn. The calves are once removed. I think that unless there's a bright line rule established with respect to the economic loss rule, we're going to double the judicial effort of every circuit judge that has to deal with one of these cases. Now, I wish I had a clear answer to your question regarding the economic loss rule. The economic loss rule is designed to take contractual disputes out of the hands of tort law if and only if there's no damage to other property.
Mr. Tundra, two issues. One, You've been asked questions about this product being unreasonably dangerous, and a good portion of your brief deals with the facts and the affidavits. I've just checked the petition for review, and the only issue before this court is assuming you are right about the facts and all the inferences, is it other property? And then before the court is not the issue whether it's unreasonably dangerous, should you have a trial? Should you go back? That's the first thing. Second thing is, there is no privity between Milk Products, Inc. and Graham's.
Correct.
Nevertheless, our cases stand for the proposition, even if you can't sue them under contract, contract law should apply to you and Milk Products, Inc. Anyway, even though you can't sue them, which bothers me a little, but I probably join that opinion. That's Dannon, right?
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Now, Justice Crooks asks you about disappointed expectations. And it seems from the discussion, if I might summarize it, that Wisconsin has at least four concepts in economic loss. You cannot plaintiff recover. You can recover only if the damage is unanticipated. Two, more than asbestos hazardous exception. You might classify it otherwise. Three, you can't recover if it's an integrated component part. And four, the seltzer disappointed expectations, which looks like unanticipated damage. Now, disappointed expectations is a contract recovery. That's Hadley v. Baxter. We learned that in law school, sure. If you and I can remember that far, which is a problem. And if you say that it can't come under the tort doctrine, it's because it's a contract doctrine. Therefore, since we don't want to mix contract and tort, that's how you get to exclude disappointed expectation. And that's exactly what Judge Deininger said in Seltzer. He said, the rationale is that claims concerning strictly economic loss are best governed by contract. And contract deals with disappointing expectations. So although no one briefed it, you weren't asked to brief it, and you have enough problems in this case without briefing it, you got a basic problem here of applying contract to your client, contract law, when you don't have a contract.
I agree we don't have a contract. The contract's between Cargill and Milk Products.
That's right. And yet they want to hold you to contract damages because you don't have a, even though you don't have a contract. And the argument is you could have made a contract with Milk Products, Inc.
Well, I don't know that that's even an argument because it was who knew who.
It's the argument in economic doctrine.
Yeah. I don't know that we even reach that point. I think that the case is talking about contract. We are talking about contract between the plaintiff and the defendant.
I'm going to put this case question to you. If we accept your concept that this is other property, and the bright line rule you state doesn't really answer it because we still have to define what other property is, even under your bright line rule, how many cases does this court have to reverse?
None right now that I know of.
Well, the Atlas brief indicates we'd have to reverse some.
I don't know how you could reverse the ones that have already been decided. Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean overturn them.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I misunderstood what you said. How many do you have to...
The wrong term. It's my fault.
I don't think you have to reverse any cases because I think your decisions in the Wisconsin Supreme Court are all correct. And I think all of your decisions in Northridge, in Dan and Jansen, and in Warsaw Tile are what the appropriate law of this state is, and that is that if you have damage to other property, then you can have a tort cause of action. And, you know, one of the cases that
What about DeHoiveter?
I'm sorry?
What about DeHoiveter?
That's a Court of Appeals opinion.
We are governed by the Court of Appeals decisions in this state. We are governed by them until we overturn them.
Well, I understand that. I think in that light, I'm not even sure DeHoiveter gets overturned because of the fact that, the silo didn't injure the cows. That's
intervening independent cause.
Yeah, somehow physically injure the cows.
Feed injured the cows.
Yeah,
the silo injured the cows.
But the product wasn't the feed. The product was the silo.
You've got an intervening independent cause.
Yes.
That's
your
argument. Okay.
Yeah, I know my red light's on, but...
One more moment just to sum up, and then you get 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I think that the DeCoster case that the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers cited in this case said it well. We do not believe a purchaser should be considered to have bargained for destruction to his property any more than he should be considered to have bargained for physical injury to himself and others. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Henkel, representing Milk Products, Inc.
May it please the Court, Honorable Counsel. The Grahams have a remedy in this case against Cargill, a national grain and feed company. Recoverability is not an issue. And as this Court recently pointed out in Cease Electric, the contract remedies are adequate for such a situation.
Well, could the Grahams have, who would they bargain for? As I understand the facts, and I think the Chief referred that we have a great deal of facts in this case. The facts are that the farmers wanted a cheaper product. Just, you correct me if I'm wrong.
Correct, Your Honor.
And they asked the salesman, who I believe was from Cargill.
Correct, Your Honor.
Do you have something that's cheaper? And he said, we do. Now, was that a contract? Could they have bargained for a contract? What, with Cargill at that time?
This is a contract with Cargill, Your Honor. There was bargaining. It is not like going into the store and buying coffee off the shelf. There was bargaining, as one does for commercial feed.
Cargill doesn't represent Milk Products, Inc., is that correct?
No, Your Honor. They're a separate corporation. And they acquired the product from Cargill.
So you're saying that they have a cause of action against Cargill right now?
The Grahams have a cause of action against Cargill, and Cargill obtained the product from Milk Products. I should correct that statement. And one may rely, I think, on commercial parties to adjust those affairs between themselves, and we tried to point that out a little bit in our brief.
Right.
How does Grahams adjust the contract issues with Milk Products, Inc.?
The Grahams do not have contract issues with Milk Products, Your Honor. There is no privity there. The contract is with their vendor.
But the economic loss doctrine is based on contract.
The economic loss doctrine, Your Honor, seeks to differentiate between tort and contract and to determine when each of them should apply.
And your argument is it should apply here, otherwise you don't get to the economic loss doctrine.
The economic loss doctrine should apply here, Your Honor, because the facts in this case are very consistent with the holdings of this court, particularly Wausau Tile and with the De Heyvetter decision of the Court of Appeals, because what we are dealing with here is failed expectations. We are instructed by the case law and the earlier decisions to take a look at the essence of the claim, and I think that language comes out of Cease Electric, because there's an effort frequently to plead around these rules and by semantics to acquire access to the tort system. And so the case law here and elsewhere says, well, let's look at the reality. What is being alleged here? And so one looks at what is the nature of the damage being claimed? What is the reality of the case? And that tells us, is this failed expectations that did not work right, which is a contract situation, or is this something else which could not have been anticipated, such as poison in the grain in the Iowa case we cited in our brief, the United Airlines case cited by the plaintiff's bar, ATLA, in which a roof suddenly and violently collapsed.
Here's the problem that I have. Unanticipated damage can include failed expectations. That's the problem. I know we're talking about them as two separate things, but I think you're going to have failed expectations either way. Would you agree?
I think, Your Honor, that failed expectations are a larger subset of the discussion. It is a failed expectation if the roof of this building crashes down upon us, but that's a matter that cannot reasonably be anticipated. It is a dangerous matter. Tort law applies without question.
And I understand that, but that's the point I'm getting at, is you're going to have failed expectations in either situation. And I'm wondering if the way the Court of Appeals opinions have been applied may have been to apply it too broadly.
Yeah. In reading the cases, Your Honor, there seems to be good definition in that failed expectations are applied to those situations in which we talk about those things that should be bargained for, those things that a reasonable businessman should think about when he is buying product. In other words, is this going to work adequately for my purpose? This is a matter of opinion frequently. There is risk involved, as this Court's decisions have pointed out. We do not bargain for poison in corn. We do not anticipate such a thing. It should not happen. It is dangerous. There is an Iowa case that we talked about, Ballard versus Amana Society, I believe, in which that was addressed.
But if you bargain for feed, don't you bargain for feed which is nutritional?
We do, Your Honor, understanding that there is not an absolute certainty that it's going to work.
Well, here, as your opposing counsel indicated, that this was a dangerous product. He used the word dangerous. So no one would bargain. You think they were bargaining for something that would be dangerous?
Indeed, Your Honor. Indeed, and again, here's why we need to look at the reality of the situation. What is the essence of the damage claim? Because semantics ought not to determine the outcome. Plaintiff will speak of dangerous because it is beneficial to his interest if he desires to be in tort. What has happened here, according to the plaintiff's experts, is that this product failed to nourish. These are young calves. There was an increased incidence of death, and some of the calves were skinny and did not thrive. That, I think, is an adequate and correct summary of the evidence. We have addressed that at significant length in our brief because we thought the court ought to have that correct.
I just wanted to ask, if you medicate, we're talking about young calves here, if you remove the medication, then there would be the danger. I mean, the reason you have the medication is to ward off some of the, quote, diseases or what other things that affect young calves. So that was a risk that not only the farmer must have known he was taking.
This is an experienced farmer, Your Honor, and he did this for his own reasons, desired a lesser cost, felt apparently that he could manage in other ways or without it. Most commonly, as the court correctly appreciates, one puts medication in young calves' feed. If the plaintiff was going to do that separately, that would be his business, I guess.
Wasn't there a problem with this particular milk replacement? Do I understand the facts correctly in that aspect, that it didn't do, even from milk products' point of view, what it was supposed to? In other words, the nutritional value wasn't high enough based on some change that in the formula?
Your Honor, there were some comments made in argument and some comments in the record as to changes. There was talk of, quote, least cost formulation, and we advised the Court of Appeals that this is how one makes feed because these are organic products and the amount of product is going to vary, you know, which sort of dried whey or whatever, within the limits, because these products vary as they are produced by nature.
Could you explain exactly what the practical consequence is of, for the Grahams, of limiting the cause of action simply against Cargill?
Well, I can best, I think, refer to the Cease Electric case, which summarized the available remedies under the Uniform Commercial Code and concluded that these, in an ordinary situation, should make the party whole. Beyond that, we have not exhaustively briefed that issue.
Mr. Henkel, as I read your brief in this case, I saw two arguments. One argument had to do with a Wausau tile approach, an integrated system approach. The other had to do with what you've discussed here this morning in oral argument, and that's disappointed or failed expectations. Which one of those horses are you riding, or are you riding both arguments or both horses?
What comes to mind immediately, Your Honor, is Seltzer versus Brunsell, where both of those doctrines were referred to. In De Heivetter, the court spoke of disappointed expectations. These are the sorts of damages one sees if the product doesn't work as we anticipate. The court in De Heivetter did not specifically refer to a, quote, integrated system, but they, without commenting, applied that sort of approach. I would submit that integrated system is a shorthand term that we use after we have determined that these are the sort of damages in a particular case which are the sort that to which contract law should apply, and then determine whether there is relative causal relatedness here. Is there some kind of relation between these events such that it makes sense to apply this doctrine? These are policy decisions, and they have been made periodically. Counsel refers to comments by the ATLA brief that simply dismiss the idea of applying that doctrine here, but without analysis, and talks about gasoline in an engine. I would cite the court to Midway Products, which is an...
Let me just stop you at this point. As I understand your response, you're basically saying that the two doctrines are not really contrary or separate doctrines, but really are tied together. Is that correct?
They are, Your Honor, and Seltzer versus Brunsell is a really good example of how that's done.
All right, thank you.
The Midway case has been some years old. It appeared in 157 Wisconsin 2nd. There, a steam generator was supplied to an electric generating facility, hooked up to it, and supplied what is termed defective steam. This was thought to be sufficiently related so that the economic loss doctrine applied. And this is an earlier case. What we are dealing with here is a policy issue. What do we do about bulk commercial products? The sort of thing that comes by the train car load or is sold by the ton in this case. If ever there is a paradigm where the economic loss doctrine should apply, it is here because it is bulk material, it is invariably commercial in nature, large dollar amount, and if the economic loss doctrine does not apply here, it practically does not exist because these things are always components. In Sunny Slope, there is a gear or something in a tractor, a component of a tractor, and the doctrine applies. In Wausau Tile, there is cement from the Medusa Company that is said to have failed and caused the destruction of the pavers. The doctrine applies. Lumber in houses, one would think the doctrine would apply. In Casa Clara, a case cited in one of our other decisions, cement is put into houses and the doctrine applies. Calf feed is also a commercial product. When we think about the range of commercial products our economy produces, be they mechanical, be they electrical, be they biological or organic, should not the doctrine apply uniformly in all cases in situations where the loss alleged is one of inadequate quality or, as here, failure to properly nourish?
Can you explain the potato case?
Your Honor, the potato case was addressed in Seltzer versus Brunsell by that court very effectively, I think. In that case, a fungicide was applied to potatoes, and it did not work. However, the potatoes were not damaged by fungus. They were caused to petrify, which is a very uncommon occurrence, apparently. This was thought to be affirmative damage. The best answer I can give, Your Honor, is the two Iowa cases, Ballard and Nelson, which we cited in our brief, because they provide the two sides of the paradigm. In the one case, Ballard, poisonous corn is provided, and the tort doctrine clearly applies. In the other, a product designed to maintain the freshness of meat or keep it from rotting is applied and does not do so. It simply fails its function, and contract law is applied. I believe that our case is exactly consistent with those.
So if you have an unexpected damage, then tort law applies. So it's unexpected you're going to have petrified potatoes.
That is the law, Your Honor.
Okay. So in this case, give me an example where the economic loss doctrine wouldn't apply. You expect that this feed is going to make these calves strong and healthy, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And it doesn't. So that's, it doesn't fulfill its function.
Correct, Your Honor.
And if it petrified them, then you get economic loss.
Well, if you added captan, which is that's what was in the potato case, it would kill all the, that's a very dangerous poison.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a difference?
It is a difference, Your Honor. For example, in Ballard versus Humana Society, the type of poison is not specified, but we anticipate it was probably aflatoxin. And, were there poison, say pesticide, in this product, one doesn't expect pesticide in one's feed any more than you or I expect a bolt in our sandwich as we go to eat this.
There was a big case of, I can't remember, but, or at least it was in the newspaper, where they mixed feeds and they mixed a poison in cattle feed and then it went out. I maybe it's coming up here, I shouldn't ask, but
years ago.
That's what I was referring to, that type of situation.
Yes, Your Honor, years ago, a fire retardant was mixed in the feed, and this, I think, happened in Michigan. And I'm going back 10 years probably in memory. And there was a fairly major problem as a result of that. That would certainly be something unanticipated. Fire retardant doesn't belong in feed. Mechanical parts do not belong in sandwiches. That sort of thing. That is not the paradigm here, Your Honor, because the veterinarians have opined that this is a failure to nourish.
Yeah, well, you expect feed to be nutritious. I mean, the whole point of buying feed is so that they don't starve, that the animals don't starve, right?
Correct.
And that in this particular case, that they're protected against disease. That's one of the theories, right?
That is a flourishing, I think they call it.
All right. May we all flourish. So, if this is not nutritious and doesn't protect against disease and slowly kills them, and there's a high percent of death here, like 30% versus the, if you believe all that, and let's just accept that, versus 7 or 8% or whatever that number is, that is not, that, you can't get damages for that, but if you kill them fast with poison, you can.
Your Honor, the law seems to differentiate between failure of function and the causing of affirmative harm. That is the differentiation in Spicala. That is the explicit differentiation in the Iowa cases, and that appears also to be what our law has been saying over time.
And I recognize that, and it sometimes it's easy to apply that. Sometimes it's hard to apply that. I recognize that, too, as sort of omission and commission.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Which is a doctrine that the negligence law got rid of a long time ago because acting and failing to act come awfully close at times.
The paradigms, I think, become more complicated than that over time, Your Honor. We're out on the dividing line here. Where do we cut it?
Yeah. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
And the question is whether you can line these cases up or not. Mm-hmm. And they don't, even if they don't line up perfectly, no set of cases ever do between us.
The Your Honor, these line up pretty closely, and Wausau Tile, as has been pointed out this morning, did a good job of unifying them. It moved a step beyond cases like Dannon and Northridge, which did not consider the outlines of the other property doctrine. It attempted and did a pretty good job of setting forth, you know, where those outlines are with respect to this very large body of things called commercial components, for instance, cement in that case, all of which constitutes a very large part of the economy, and if ever there is to be an economic loss doctrine, it should apply to those components, and that, I think, is why Wausau Tile was decided as it was, Your Honor.
Is there something the Grahams could have done to enable them to reach the defendants here, Midwest or milk, no, milk products?
Your Honor, they had no dealings at all with milk products until after there were problems and somebody came out to investigate. I don't know that they could, Your Honor, because their contractual relations were entirely with Cargill.
Well, you know, when I reread Dannon and I had Justice Prosser's question in mind, if Graham sue Cargill because they can contract with each other, and Cargill can sue your client,
correct,
milk products, because they can contract with each other. When I read Dannon, keeps saying, oh, we can't make the manufacturer liable because they get socked with everything. You know, and that's just, you know, you go into the deepest pocket down the line and that's the end of this. But the truth is, I think, that milk products can, between itself and cargo, protect itself and say, we're not liable to any of your buyers with an indemnification.
One can posit such a possibility, Your Honor. I can't comment on whether it's feasible or realistic.
Right. Well, you can do it another way. You just say you release us from all liability to third parties.
I would see major problems with that from a legal standpoint, Your Honor.
In the sense that
it is very difficult to do.
You mean to get Cargill to buy under those conditions? Or that we don't recognize releases so easily?
I think, by and large, we do not recognize such releases.
No, all of the above, right.
Yes. No releases.
Yeah, that more likely, Your Honor, is the scenario in these commercial situations that retailing parties are going to settle affairs with their manufacturing parties directly and in a commercial fashion, and it's going to be in a way that probably doesn't involve the courts, because commercial parties who continue to deal are going to adjust their affairs and move on, and that, I would submit, is one of the purposes of contract law as it is.
But in the Graham versus Cargill lawsuit, would Cargill bring you in as an intervening party or bring you in as the third party because they would expect you to stand behind your product?
It is possible because Cargill has a cause of action against No Products Company.
That's what I'm asking you.
They do.
Okay. Because there is privity there.
There is privity.
And either there is an express warranty or an implied warranty of fitness.
All of the various contractual remedies subject to whatever agreement that may or may not exist, and I can't comment on that off the top of my head.
Sure. And you should not concede anything on that here, and I'm not asking for that.
I'm just
tracking it.
Right. The point of the discussion, I suppose, comes to this. That once we have determined that there is to be such a doctrine, we must deal with the question of the component parts, the large quantity commercial products, bulk products, if you will, that must be dealt with, must be covered if this doctrine is to be meaningful. They will always be a component of something. And if the supposed bright line test sought by plaintiff's counsel were invoked, in each case, the manufacturers could be sued and the economic loss doctrine would, for all practical purposes, not exist, and that I would submit as the purpose of that argument. A number of cases have been cited by counsel for the Academy of Trial Lawyers, and I think we've dealt with some of those. These deal with a distinction, by and large, between what is anticipated and what is not to be anticipated, the collapsing roof in United Airlines. The case cited, the cluster cited by counsel in Maryland, had to do with the death of an entire flock of chickens. Apparently the ventilation failed, and indeed one does not bargain for such a thing, but we do not have to decide a case like that here, because our paradigm here is very much closer to Wausau Tile. The Grahams are producing an organic product, heifers, if you will, or heifer replacement calves, and one of the inputs they required was feed, as in Wausau Tile. An input was cement that was required to make the pavers, which self-destructed because of apparent defect in the cement. And we urge, therefore, that the court uphold the high bidder and apply the economic loss doctrine to this case, as it appears to be consistent with the existing rulings of this court and other cases. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Henkel. Mr. Tundra, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Just a couple of comments that I think are appropriate. Mr. Henkel said that the affairs between manufacturer and retailer will be adjusted among them generally without necessity for litigation. This adjustment among them sort of leaves out the consumer who's been injured by the product.
Just one minute. But the consumer does have his opportunity to sue Cargill. There's no question about that, right?
There's no question about that. Okay. There's no question about
that. And just to follow up, Cargill could potentially, if that lawsuit were to be brought, bring in milk products.
Correct.
Right. So it isn't that you're without a remedy. You want to get in to a different remedy. That's basically what this argument's about.
Correct.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened in Wausau Tile.
Yes.
And this court said in Wausau Tile that the concrete manufacturer, or that the Wausau Tile can't sue the concrete manufacturer in tort, but intimates that the third party injured by the tile, or the third party's property injured by the tile, can sue the concrete manufacturer in tort. And what we have to remember is that bigger than contract law is public policy. Public policy is to protect the consumer against dangerous products. And there's a second prong to that. There's a second prong to public policy. And that second prong is to encourage the manufacturer to put a safe product in the marketplace. And if he can deal in the closed confines...
Counselor, that's where your argument gives me lots of problems, because I don't see this product as unsafe. I don't think it fits within Dippel versus Scano, even if you can get out from under the economic loss doctrine argument.
I don't know that that's an issue on which certiorari was granted. But
oh, but it's your argument that you're just making right there for us, and I agree it's not an issue that's currently before us.
All I'm saying is that has to be accepted as true for to get to this argument. And
not necessarily. Well, we're looking at whether this is a damage to other property, and I'm not sure that you have to have an unreasonably dangerous product to address that issue.
Well, I direct your attention, I suppose, to Northridge again, where the court says we conclude that the plaintiffs are entitled to offer evidence to support their claims. Whether the plaintiffs will ultimately prevail on their claim that the defendant's unreasonably dangerous product caused injury to property other than the product itself is a question of fact to be determined.
The Chief Justice pointed out that in Northridge, you're dealing with asbestos. And I think that I'm just going to take judicial notice of the fact that there are thousands and thousands of asbestos cases and dealing with an unknown, that was an unknown at the time it was used. Isn't that a different type of situation?
Well, I don't read the case that way, Your Honor. And Seltzer, I believe, discussed this issue of whether this was a hazardous product exception. And if you look at the Northridge case, it bottoms out on the question of whether the asbestos physically harmed the building. It doesn't bottom out on the question of whether asbestos is harmful or dangerous. It bottoms out on, is there damage to other property? I mean, are we gonna let manufacturers escape the light of their day in front of a jury under this economic loss rule when they put a product on the market that harms other property? I mean, 402A's been around a long time.
Okay, somebody's cell phone was on.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Tondriff. Thank you, Mr. Hankel, for yet another economic loss doctrine case to come to our court. That concludes our hearing in 03-0801, Grahams versus Milk Products, Inc. We'll take a few moments in recess so the students may leave, council can retire, and a new group of council can be handed out later.